Annette will go after me and talk about the pseudo-Liouville equation. And this is a session on kinetic theory of granular gases. So this talk is based on a talk I gave a few weeks ago in the APS. But what I tried to do is make it more more of a review of the type of behavior that you get for granular gases. So there are several new results I'd like to get into, but I'd like to put them in context. So first, I would like to start with the basics. What are the collision rules and collision rates for granular collision in elastic collisions? Then explain the Boltzmann equation, which is the starting point, the kinetic theory for granular material undergoing inelastic collisions. I'll talk about four types of solutions of the Boltzmann equation. One is the forced steady state, which is the most relevant for experiments. And then three, which is the Boltzmann equation with forcing. And then three, which is type of solution of the Boltzmann equation without forcing. And I thought I'll start with something that has more experiments, experimental data that we can confirm with. And those, there's actually none, although there's some suggestion for experiments. And this seems like a lot, and the way I will be able to cover a lot is by focusing on one aspect of this distribution, which is the tails. If I would have to talk about the core of the distribution, I'll really need another talk. So I made a decision to sort of, it's a biased decision to work with the linearized Boltzmann equation and show you how many features follow from the statistics of extreme velocities. But please, if you are interested in other type, for example, what is the shape of the core, please talk to me after this talk. There are many experiments about vibrated and driven granular systems. And here I've just listed a number of experiments where the system is kept in a homogeneous state. So roughly speaking, the system is driven hard so that the energy pumping from typically from the boundary of the system compensates for the energy dissipation that occurs in the bulk. And moreover, those systems remain more or less homogeneous. At least there is a sense of thinking about them as spatially homogeneous system. There's no gradients that develop. Yeah, I know that there are much more experiments in granular gases, but you can have a spatial or vertical or horizontal gradient. I'm sure that I've overlooked many of this, many of the experiments. I mean, I'll need a few more transparencies to cover all the work that was done. So this is just a cartoon of the system. We have particles that move as in a gas, and the only difference is that their collisions are dissipating energy. Now, I think this is a fundamental aspect of granular materials, because when we write fluid dynamics equation, we write mass conservation. Well, we do have that. We write momentum conservation equation. We do have that in granular materials. And I believe that every fluid dynamics description of granular materials must incorporate those inequalities that we have in the flow. So I was quite confused by the introductory talk that we had last week, where those issues were not mentioned. But we don't have energy dissipation. And the way we compensate for energy dissipation is that we write a dissipative term in the equations, which is an energy sink. This energy sink can be derived theoretically. However, there is some phenomenological aspect to this sink, because those flows, as we know, do not remain homogeneous. Nevertheless, I'd like to go back to sort of the beginning and tell you what we do have to understand, sort of the baseline, which is homogeneous systems. And in order for the system to be in a steady state, there has to be balance between energy loss, which typically occur due to collision, and energy injection that occurs somehow, either through the boundary of the system or through the maybe the environment that the system interacts with, say a fluid or turbulent air, or there has to be another mechanism to force the system. Typically in our granular material experiment, we shake this box. And shaking this box, interestingly enough, plays a role of white noise. when we model the system. The reason is that those particles are very dilute and they collide with comparable frequencies with the wall and with other particles. And you say, okay, when I collide with the wall here, now, and there later, there's no correlation between the position and no correlation between the times. And we are shaking the system in on one time scale, say 20 hertz, and then the collision occur in another time scale, say 1 hertz. I mean, I'm just, there's separation of time scales. And then this sort of white noise driving makes sense. And the type of things we're interested in is what is the temperature of the system, what is the behavior of the typical particles. If I just pick one particle and ask, you know, what's your velocity, what's your temperature? And also, what is the entire distribution? And I'd like to emphasize that when we ask about the velocity distribution, we are going to be asking about, often, about the core of the distribution, the typical, most of the particle, and then the tail, which will be maybe 1 out of 1,000 particles, which is happen to be very energetic. And it turns out, I'll pay a lot more attention in this talk to this question, but you learn a lot from extreme statistics about the mechanism for energy injection and energy dissipation. So in one dimension, I'll be most explicit in about one dimension. And in one dimension, we have momentum conservation. So this is the space-time diagram of the system. So two particles collide and they bounce off, such that the angle in space-time between their trajectories is reduced by factor r, which we term the restitution coefficient. So this is this factor r. Yeah, so there's a triangle here. There is this. Torsten, you look lost. You know, you wrote a book. If I lose you, then I definitely lost everybody else.
Sorry, no, it's just...
So this is...
It's just one dimension also. There's only...
X and T, yeah. But you learn a lot from this picture. You learn that this is a... one thing you learn about that this is a irreversible system. If I reverse the time arrow, I get something which is nonsensical. I get energy generation. And in that sense, that we cannot reverse the time direction, the system is a non-equilibrium system. If I take a movie of a shaken granular system and I play the movie backward, I will know that I'm playing it backward. So the system is a fundamentally non-equilibrium systems. So I know which way time is going. And this is also the other thing is that if this were an elastic collision, those trajectory will be passing through each other, but in general, in general, those two particles have knowledge of each other post the collision. They are more correlated than they were before. And that is the source of the buildup of correlation in the system that eventually leads to massive spatial correlation. And the velocity difference between those two particles, this angle is reduced by a factor of r between 0 and 1. So r 0 is completely inelastic collision, and r equal 1 is elastic collision. So I hope I didn't lose anybody. And in general, in any dimension, it's the same thing, except we have to separate the normal and the tangential components, where n is the vector connecting the centers of the particle. And we do different stretching in the normal and tangential direction. And there will be the same dissipation factor. Here I've taken, assume that only of normal restitution, so this is Rn, but there will be similar but more complicated factor into tangential, and that will be also coupling the linear and rotational degrees of freedom. But for this talk, I will ignore the rotational motion and worry only about the normal restitution. It turns out that the way we understand the system, most of the physics is contained, most of the phenomenology will emerge by studying this. But of course, if you're trying to model an experiment where rotational is playing a big role, one has to worry about the rotational degrees of freedom as well. And this is this law, and this is our notation. So this is U1 and U2. Already from this, you can deduce that this system does not, or cannot, and should not have a normal or equilibrium velocity distribution. Just that by this innocent looking collision rules, we can deduce that we do not have Maxwellian distribution. So in order to understand why we don't have Maxwellian distribution, we have to go back to Maxwell's argument, saying that the velocity distribution is isotropic, it's a function of the velocity only, or alternatively a function of the energy. And the other one is that the velocity distribution decouples into a universal velocity distribution for each of the components. So Fvx, Vy, Vz is a product. That means that there is no coupling whatsoever between Vx and Vy. If I look at higher moment of Vx to the fifth, fourth, whatever, I can deduce moments of the entire velocity. And the only solution that you have for these two constraints is the Gauss distribution, or Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. Now, for granular particles, this breaks down. What breaks down is this. We of course can expect that even under those collision rules, the velocity distribution will be a function of the energy only, or the velocity. But this breaks down. And the reason this breaks down is precisely the way we define the collision rule. We are going to take the velocity component and we will do a stretching. We will do a dissipation in one direction of one type and another dissipation of another kind in that direction. This is why I wrote these collision rules here. So those numbers are unrelated. They are tunable parameters. They're going to be different for different materials. And because of those two numbers, that they're not one, we are discriminating the direction. So say, for example, that we don't do anything in the tangential direction. We pick one of the d direction, you know, x, y, z, the normal component. So that set our coordinate system. We will call that the x direction. And we do a stretching along. That stretching violates that, because we didn't do any stretching in other directions, so we discriminated one. It also tells you that restitution or deviation from this formula will be proportional to inverse of the dimension, because out of the d dimension in the system, we picked one direction and we did something along this direction. And the deviation from this distribution should also be proportional to the degree of the stretching. So if I do no stretching, r is 1, I will have no deviation. So this amount of deviation, which can be quantified, for example, via kurtosis of the distribution or other measure that of correlation between, say, the different components. I'll come back to experimental, very small. One or two experimental curves that actually observe this deviation from Maxwell distribution, but it has been seen in many studies in granular gases driven, and this deviation takes a different form, and it's very complicated. But generically, I would like to make the point is that you cannot have a Maxwellian distribution when you have dissipation in this form. The Boltzmann equation is nothing but a translation of this collision rule subject to a particular collision rate to the population of velocities of a different velocity. So we have the velocity distribution is really counts. It's a histogram for how many particles we have of each velocity.
So is the capital P on the left hand side?
Oh, and it's an F, yeah. Done. Parts of it were done late last night, so I'll go down and correct everything and put the correct thing on my website when I'm done. So yes, this is F, and we are basically, this is a master equation for how the velocity distribution changes with time. Now, let's just go. First, we have to integrate over the incoming velocity U1 and U2, count for how many particles we have of that species. Then we have to account for the rate for which they collide, which I will say something on this in a minute. But for now, I would like to stress the two delta function. There's a gain term, which is basically rewrites the collision rule. So that I gain this velocity and that velocity, and I lose those two velocity. Because of symmetry, I will only take care of this gain. The other term will really look the same. This term will be just interchange of 1 and 2. And I lose this velocity. Okay, and since the collision rules in one dimension, you can be written in linear form, I will make this transformation and re-express the restitution as 1 minus 2p. We will have two parameters, p and q, such a P and Q equal one. For one dimension, this turns out to be quite useful transformation. So the equation are nonlinear and non-local. But wait a second, if we look at elastic collision, the equations are also nonlinear and non-local. The key for granular particles is that they're also dissipative. If I will calculate the energy loss, if we'll calculate the temperature, so integral d dt of v square f of v dv, it will be a quantity that decays with time. So we have energy loss. This can be generalized in to any dimension. I will not write that, but I would like to say something about the collision rate. And the collision rate, Maxwell, what he did, the way he solved this kinetic theory originally, is he figured out that for particles that interact with 1 over r to the fourth potential, the collision rate is independent of the velocity. And the collision that simplifies this kinetic theory tremendously.
Maxwell did choose something like that, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, he did. Yeah.
Well, the fourth power.
It chose exactly, he derived this distribution, Maxwellian distribution, by choosing a potential that goes like 1 over r to the fourth, and I will show where it's coming from. The reason is that this term goes away, and we have a pure convolution, and we can do Fourier transform. We can solve everything. That's really what myself and Paul Krapivsky did for granular particles. That's how we sort of were able to characterize this deviation from Maxwellianity. So you can kill this term. That is just wonderful for theorists.
The only problem is that such molecules don't exist in our world.
We will see later that they do. How? But that's fine. I'm formulating the kinetic theory in general, and lambda can be either zero, between zero and one. And if you care to care only about hard spheres, then imagine that lambda is one. So I've not done the theoretical cost of putting this lambda here is zero, a labor cost. And really, where did this collision rate comes for? You say that you have a kinetic and potential energy, and you balance them. So v square, so the particle interact with r minus lambda potential. So v square is typically like r minus lambda. That gives you a scaling between the typical distance between particle and the velocity. And now you say that the collisional cross section, so what Robin Ball did with this aggregation when we were trying to do ballistic aggregation, so it's velocity time radius to the power of d minus 1. R to the d minus 1 is the surface area of the particle, and v is the velocity. That gives you the volume swept per unit time. And I plug this estimate, and I get this collision rate. So sigma, the cross section, is just the collision rate with this power. There's an assumption here, of course. The assumption is that the distance the particle are going to come is dominated by this balance of kinetic and potential energy. But I just thought I'd put this because it's quite neat. And you see that for d equal 2, gamma has to be 2 to have Maxwellian molecules. That's dipolar interaction. And we have now experiments for magnetic particles interacting with dipole interaction that rather confirm this. And for d equal 2, gamma equal 4. And that's what Maxwell did. So, but being able to work out that this, the grind through the equation and solve them completely is there's a lot of insight in it. Okay, so out of this list, I've covered the collision rules and the collision rate and the nonlinear Boltzmann equation. And now I would like to talk about extremely energetic particles. And for now on, all the results that I will present will be primarily concerning the tail of the distribution. And the key, this is maybe something that will be a little hard to grasp at first. So please ask me, because almost everything I'll say in the talk is based on this view graph. Think about the particle, think about the restitution being equal to zero. So r is zero, that means that two velocities that collide, we just average the velocity. So we have a velocity of 1,000. Think about the velocity, particle of velocity 1,000 collides with the particle of velocity 1. And the restitution is zero. So p equal q equal 1/2. That means that the two outgoing particle will have, one of them will have velocity of 500.5 and the other one of 499.5, such that momentum is conserved. If I didn't mess up this elementary addition. Essentially, I can. So what did I learn from that? I learned from that that I really did not need to worry about the small particle. I can say that those two particles each have velocity 500. And as I take v to infinity, this approximation will become exact. So I can throw away this particle and worry only about the energetic particle and say that it gets split into two smaller particles of velocity p and q. And that is what I've written here. Energetic particles undergo a cascade process, which is now linear but non-local. It's non-local because I stretch the velocities, and it's also a cascade process because I double the number of particles, according to this cartoon. There's also a collision rate, v to the lambda, because we're going to set, as we set in the collision rule, one of the velocity to zero, say u2 to zero, I got u1 goes to pu1, qu2, qu1, which is what's written here. And also the collision rate, u1, u2, I will have to set u2 to zero, we will have u1 to the lambda. So I can, and u1 we will call v, so the collision rate is v to the lambda. So the faster the particle goes, the more likely it is to undergo this cascade. There's also a rate by which this occurs. That's it. That linearizes the Boltzmann equation. And we could have derived this, and that linearizes this equation. And where does this again is time, df dt here. The rate of change of the velocity distribution, well, I have a loss term, minus fv, for the particle on the left, and I have two gain terms for the two gained particles.
Could you write the expressions for p and q again?
Yes. I know that we have about 10 different notation for restitution. You can see, even without worrying about anything, you can see that p plus q has to be equal to 1.
Right.
Because momentum
is typically small compared to 1. That's sort of the case that we're
interested in. Not necessarily. Vary between a half and 1.
Can you derive that from the Boltzmann equation?
Yes, I will hint how. So before that, Joachim's question, and then I'll come to yours. So r is 1 minus 2p. So when r is 1, p is 0. When r is 0, p is a half. And in general, p plus q equal 1. I could derive this law from the collision rules that I've had before, just assuming that I have one particle colliding with the particle 0, implement momentum conservation and restitution. That will imply this law. I've chosen this particular notation, p and q, because obviously it is simple.
But this looks as if you only lose large velocities, right? It's sort of fragmented.
Yes. It's a
this is
well. We'll come back to that later. That's the whole point. I mean,
okay.
That's, yeah, that is the whole point. How do you create them? We will come back to that. I mean, so now to your question. I have derived this linearized Boltzmann equation from the collision rule. It is a little bit like the Navier-Stokes. You could derive it from the Boltzmann equation, but you can also have derived it from conservation laws and other stuff. And I think that other stuff tells you that you really didn't need the Boltzmann equation to begin with because you use physics. This is the physics. Now, if you want to, you like the mathematics, it's very simple. It's a saddle point analysis of this equation. You have fu1, fu2, and you're looking at fv extremely large. V is like 10 times, 50 times RMS. The only way you can create those is if one of those dominate over the other one. And you basically, this integration factorizes into two integrals, one over a small velocity and one over a large velocity. So the integral over this velocity factorizes, and then you're left with the linear equation. So you can derive this linear equation by being carefully handling this equation with yeah. So, yes.
I mean, the elegant derivation of the Taylor distribution, I mean, the next step we have immediately is here. But I worry a bit about time. I mean, you have an extremely dissipative process. I mean, what? Well,
yeah.
Energy vanishes completely. Only as the relative motion.
It depends.
It's extremely dissipative in any case. But the last equation doesn't contain any time. How long is the time?
Time is here.
Oh, it's T.
You're right. With this typo, there's no time. But this time is here.
There's time.
There's time.
Well, you have
here.
Cascading
the cascade is a rate, and the rate is a time dependent, sets the time scale for the process. So,
there's no cascading process.
Sorry?
There's result was steady
process? Well, I will show that this process has many, many states that it supports. But one has to sort of recast it as a complicated process into a simpler process, which is really what's happening for large velocities. So Joachim is absolutely right. We have a fragmentation process, but I think most people here are not familiar with this terminology.
But the velocity v itself should contain time, and f should also contain time. Time
f
two times.
F has the dimension of 1 over velocity and 1 over density. I mean, density over velocity. You integrate f, you should get the density.
It's created out by dividing v by the square root of the function.
I think some of your questions will be answered soon.
Can you tell us how we know that that's a linear equation in V?
Because it's linear if in F, because all I specified is what happened.
It's linear in F, not in V.
It's linear in F. It's non-local in V. It has the stretching, so it is non-linear in V. In a sense, it is like infinite non-linearity, because you have an infinite memory. So here, V, in this V, you know what PV, you know what V here is. You're coupled to all those multiples of P, P squared, PQ, 2PQ, so on. So it's linear in F because I specified the fate of one particle, energetic particle. So energetic particles, they decouple from the slow particles, obviously, because they are unaffected. When this 1,000 hits a zero, well, it couldn't care less. It just all in, but it does need this zero in order to do something. So it mediates the collision or the cascade.
How can considerations about one particle give you the distribution function?
It will give me the distribution function for the tail, because when you're dealing with extreme statistics, that is sufficient.
There's only one particle that will dominate.
Yes. Yes. Of course, having other particles is crucial, because if you didn't have the nonlinear equation to start with, there will be some problem. You have to have, they regularize the behavior. Eventually, so this is our distribution. F of V is this. When you're talking about the tail, you don't need to worry about it. But when you're talking about the core and the typical particles, so I'm talking about one out of 1,000 particles here.
Why can't you go straight to the, I can't remember if it's a Gumbel or Weibull or whatever. I mean, there's only one distribution for the extreme statistics in the tail, so it has to be that.
No, because it will depend on the type of states I am in. I'll show you.
But it's a standard statistical proof that the extreme value from any distribution tends to the same thing.
Well, for dissipative particle, this doesn't hold. I will show that depending on how I force or not force the system, there is a whole slew of behavior, stretch exponential, power law, solution of this particular equation.
This is for extremes of independent random variables.
This is not really well. Those are multiple interacting particles. Yes. Thank you, Joachim. You articulated that better. This is an interacting particle system. Although this is infinitely dilute, think about those particles. Really, think about this Boltzmann equation as a Monte Carlo. You would do a Monte Carlo simulation. You have a graduate student, and you want to tell them to solve this equation. The way the graduate student should solve this, which is should take zero intellectual effort, is to take all those particles in a box, pull those two particles, collide them inelastically according to the collision rate, and put them back. That would be the Maxwell model. If you want to do hard sphere, you take two particles on the box and collide them only with the rate proportional to their relative velocity, and then put them back in the box, because there's really no space. What this assumption here, which I failed to neglect, is very important, is this, I think our German friend will have to...
Postzahlansatz.
Exactly. So we are making this, that this is the thing I can only spell but not pronounce. We're making this assumption here that there's no spatial correlation. So in a way, I know, Jerry, this might sound very, very offensive to an for an experimentalist, but this is happening in infinite dimensional space, in no space. There's no space here. We've taken the notion of space out of the game.
The velocity is very large. The probability of two very high velocity particles colliding is small compared to the probability of a high velocity particle colliding with some other particle.
Yeah. And this is expressed right here. If you will have a Gaussian E minus V over VRMS, and you have say you're looking at a particle of 10 VRMS, this will be e to the minus 100. And this will be also e to the minus 100. So you better maximize one of those. It's really, So the same thing happened in any dimension. And for now, let me forget about the angles of the particles and just worry about the magnitude of the vector, which tells the energy. The energy of the particle, again, is fragmented into two pieces. And now those pieces are dependent on the angle of impact. So they're going to be now P and Q, which are going to be theta dependent. And I will, those are the parameters. They're very simple. Unfortunately, there is an average now over the various angles. And depending on what distribution of impact angle you'll put, you'll get different results. But schematically, this is how the program goes. And it's interesting to note that, of course, alpha square plus beta square has to be smaller than one. There is energy dissipation. But nicely enough, for energetic particle and energetic particles only, the length of those two vectors is always bigger than the length of this vector. And this is anywhere for d bigger than 1. For d equal 1, those two vectors, they sum up precisely to that because it's a redundant, momentum conservation is a redundant condition. But here, this is the angle between the particle, as long as it's not a head-on impact collision. If it's head-on impact, alpha plus beta is 1. But if it's not head-on, then those two vectors, their magnitude sum up to more than 1. So we have a longer vector if we add this, the product of this cascade process. So the only thing to really important to take from here is that these parameters that in one dimension we had sort of under control, they acquire dependent on the angle, which will make real calculation a mess. Okay, so now before we take to the, let's try and make a collection with experiments. And this was a very, very important and nice impact by Van Noyck and Ernst. Their insight was says, well, we don't know how to force the system, but as a physicist, maybe the first thing to say is that we force the system randomly. Is that the way we force it now and the way we force it later, and the way we force it here and the way we force it there, they're uncorrelated. So they say, let's say that particles undergo inelastic collisions, and also they are influenced by white noise. So they get kicks. So this is thermal driving. Technically, as a theoretical physicist, you must say there's no reason for this to hold when in an athermal system and all that stuff. But this is the first starting point, and as long as it holds and described as our experiments, maybe we should be content. That amounts to adding a diffusive term to the Boltzmann equation, because now we added the process. And we have to now balance this diffusion term and the forcing and this cascade equation for the tail. And what do we have in this equation? We have of f of, say, 10 RMS, and say p equal q equal half, 20 RMS here and 20 RMS here. We should throw those two terms away. So only the loss term remains for large particles. I think you might think about it that it's the particles that didn't collide that are still there.
The diffusion equation depends on the entire range of FV in terms of
yes.
The right-hand side, you're only looking at the tail.
Absolutely, and there will be flux, but this condition is still a local condition, and I'm applying it locally. Absolutely.
But you don't have a boundary condition.
The distribution is infinitely extended. I would like to point out that this is forcing at all scales of velocity. We are adding energy to the system at all scales. When you do that, it is basically WKB, if you want to be fancy. Analysis of this equation will give you a stretch exponential tail, and it will vary between E minus V and E minus V to the 3 half. In practice, this variation is really not that large.
Okay. The result you're getting is because you're forcing equally at all.
Yes, yes.
So it's not a property of the Boltzmann equation, sir.
Well, the balance, this is, forcing is here, is encoded here. The strength of the forcing is here. And this is whatever the Boltzmann equation does for, and high, again, energetic only particles. And that balance alone give you this stretch exponential result. Now, because this exponent is smaller than 2, we call it overpopulation. So this is overpopulation with respect to a Maxwellian. This is just a nomenclature. So this is appears to be quite useful for describing experiments. Again, I've discriminated two experiments for which I have the access to the data. But I have another comment on this. The comment on this is that if we rescale V by V over square root of D, then the velocity distribution is independent of the forcing term D. So the forcing magnitude sets a temperature scale for the system. But once you rescale by this temperature, there's a universal distribution. So that distribution is not the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, but it's something else. And that is useful.
Is this even true with lambdas?
This is true for any thing. It's just a rescaling of the velocity. And it is, one can work it through.
Okay.
And because you will have here really the dimension, say lambda is 1, you have v here, 1 over v square here, and you have d. So you have to rescale d at some parallel v, and then it goes away. So for strong enough forcing, it's universal. And that is something that is observed in experiment, at least certain type of highly, what I call highly agitated experiments. There are two experiments. This is probably the most famous in this business, and a follow-up experiment. The blue curve is Maxwellian. The red curve is this overpopulated tail, the theory, the kinetic theory. You see that if we did the experiment and we could resolve f of v up to 10 to the minus 3, that there'll be very little difference. There's a Maxwellian core, and then there's a deviation, and then there's a stretch or overpopulated tail. Of course, if we could resolve the distribution to 10 to the minus 8, the difference between the blue and the red curve would be huge. But in practice, we don't have that. But you can see that different experiments done with very different type of particles that does adhere to this forced kinetic theory.
Which exponent is used in that fit of the experimental
data? None. That's the point. That
delta, what value of delta?
Oh.
3 has probably.
Well, I think that I would. There's a reason why I'm ambiguous here, because I think that from this type of data, you cannot resolve the exponent, and here's the evidence. It turns out that this is Maxwellian is here. This is red is hard sphere, which has a 3 over 2 exponent, and black has an exponent of 1. The thing is, to really see an exponent means that you have to have a straight line here. And you have to go to 10 to the minus 8 to see a straight line. And I don't know. This is the experiment, which was claimed to be agreeing with this red curve. This is another theory, which is the Maxwell theory. I mean, it's nonsensical to fit an exponent here. Well, the data is still curved. And I don't know how to say this better. It's just nonsense.
Well, you did say that it agrees with.
Well, within the range that we can observe, we see something which is overpopulated, a Maxwellian core and a Maxwellian core and an overpopulated tail, but there's a whole family of kinetic theories between here and here, and it's not obvious within this data which one would fit best.
You say that it's at least 3/2, or?
I would say that is smaller than 3/2.
Can you go to the next order?
Which is what I have here, smaller than 3/2.
Smaller than 3/2.
Yeah. And I would not even claim that this green curve is universal with that, because in order to do that, we got to have the kurtosis for this curve, and the data that we have experimentally, the kurtosis will have an error bars that are very big. So here's the Maxwellian will have a kurtosis of 3. This will have a kurtosis of 3.6, which is only 20% difference, and the hard sphere will have a kurtosis of 3.3. I don't know. I don't think that the experimental data is at that level. I mean, this green data that I know that this 3.6 has a small error bar on it.
I'm confused between all these exponents.
Okay.
You've got delta here, but before you were expressing deviation in terms of.
Okay, so maybe I should.
Gamma. So.
Maybe I should summarize the result. So for white. Noise forcing, we have the tail is E minus V 1 plus lambda over 2. And for hard sphere, you'll have 3/2, and for Maxwell molecule, you'll have 1. So this is one type of velocity distribution that we see for the tail. This is the V goes to infinity behavior.
Can you calculate the next order in the asymptotic approximation and then actually fit the curve down?
Better. That would probably extend our understanding to smaller. But I think at that point you're better off just doing direct simulation Monte Carlo and calculate the entire curve and have the entire distribution. I don't see it's really nothing to solve this equation with computer. So that's what I did. I calculated its fourth moment, sixth moment, but I cannot tell you what just calculate the distribution. I mean, it's not difficult.
I thought lambda equals zero was the Maxwellian case.
That was the Maxwell molecules.
That's
yeah.
Molecules.
Yes, which give you an exponential decay. They give an exponential decay, and it's actually the red curve that I have plotted here.
It's not the same as the Maxwell distribution, which is
no.
Squared.
No, so this is, okay, so let me try and be not...
Two things that are labeled by Maxwell.
Fine. You see, the thing about the special about the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution is that no matter what the interaction potential is, you always get, for elastic particles, you always get a Gaussian, a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. For inelastic particles, the shape of the distribution depends on the sort of the collision rate or the interaction between the particles. So once you took that symmetry, which is energy conservation, you lost universality. Once you lost universality, we have a whole slew of kinetic theories that one can worry about.
Maybe just one clarification.
Yeah.
Depends on only on the collision rate and the dissipation of the particles, or it depends on the dissipation as well as the forcing?
Well, I've shown that with forcing, you get a certain family of steady states,
but that
which is here.
Is restricted to this diffusive forcing?
Yes. Yes, if you will have another thermostat, you will have another tail. This is particular to this, so it's nothing universal about it. It's completely phenomenological. We work with white noise because it's the simplest thing to do.
Not just for my...
I know it's might be a little bewildering. I'm trying to make sense out of it. So please ask me if...
Is this white noise used other places? In velocity space? This is white noise in velocity space?
Yes. What?
This is exactly a weak point here. I mean, perhaps one should mention that this graph has a problem. And this problem is that if you consider again how this function was derived, namely, it was derived by assuming independent motion as a particle. Then it was equilibrium in second. It was derived by assuming white noise in the velocity space. And if you consider now how the experiment was done, none of these preconditions holds true.
Yeah.
That means that we have to wonder why they agree so perfectly.
But I would like to make the following point, is that by worrying about the tail and working with linear equations, we have cured one thing. We have cured the dependence on the Stosch-Ansatz assumption, because this tail thing, this cascade process does not assume, it's a much weaker assumption. The linearized Boltzmann equation for the tail holds over a much broader set of conditions than the original fully nonlinear. Because it is linear, because it is just a straight translation of the collision rule, it has very little assumption in it.
The assumption you are referring to is molecular chaos.
Yes. Molecular chaos is an extremely strong condition, because we know that each collision correlates the particle. So it is paradoxical, indeed, as Thorsten says, that the mean field theory works so well.
And the very specific heating,
And with a very specific heating.
As regards the heating, I mean, because the collision rates depend on velocities, why doesn't, I mean, has anybody looked at the effect of the diffusion constant, the eta? I mean, eta could be the coefficient which is proportional to V or mod V or something like that. I mean, how does that alter the asymptotic analysis?
It will change the exponents. Obviously, yeah.
Just put it into the lambda, right?
Yeah. I guess, yeah, it's like tuning lambda, you might say. So maybe I'm right. Maybe this Maxwell is working for the wrong reasons. But if I can, okay.
I think the priming actually helps the assumption of molecular chaos, because you kick the particles randomly. I mean,
absolutely.
What
Absolutely. Because when you shake the box, you're killing correlations. When you pump energy in, you kill correlations. Well, so you're...
Back to the expanded experiment, how it's done. I mean, if you shake a box...
I would like for Annette to have some time. So now I will kill this forcing, which is ambiguous, and come back to a theoretically unambiguous question, which is what are the nature of the steady state or states of the system without forcing? And here, basically, you can do, in a sense, the fluid, the hydrodynamics, which is worrying about how the temperature... So now I'm back to this unforced equation. And this is what Huff did in 20-something years ago. And just look at the temperature, how much energy is lost in the collision, what is the collision rate, and cook up an equation for how the temperature decays with time. And then you see the temperature decays as some power law. So the energy goes away. It's like you take a bucket of sand and just dump it on the floor, and it just comes to rest. So this is then seems like it's all very simple. I would like to say that this half cooling law you can get just by matching the collision rate. It's coming back to your question with the only time scale in the problem, which is time itself. So this dimensional analysis gives you. You don't need even this hydrodynamic. It's just a reflection of the collision rate. Okay. And then you see that the velocity distribution comes to a stop from this blue curve to a red, from a red hot to a blue curve, colder curve, in a self-similar way. So there's a similarity solution of the equation. And this similarity solution, we will worry only about the tail, obeys this linear equation. And again, in this linear equation, we will kill this term and do WQ and B and get E minus Z to the lambda. So this is another type of solution that we have, very well known and extremely heavily studied, which is the freely cooling case. And the freely cooling case, F goes like E minus V to the lambda. It was first derived by Thorsten.
Sorry, again, in this case, where is the source?
There is no source. You let the particle dissipate energy via an elastic collision, they come to a rest in self-similar form, as here.
Okay, is there a source because the particle velocity is remaining at constant, the temperature is decreasing, so on the curve the particle is going up?
The particle becoming, this particle are becoming smaller and smaller and they all come to rest. So the eventual distribution f of v is delta function, is delta of v. Delta function, everybody has zero velocity. But the way that they become zero velocity is via this self-similar curve.
No, but if you do extreme statistics on this, you kill out those first two terms there.
It's again, this term is going to be a lot smaller than this term.
Yeah, so the left-hand side is coming from?
From basically plugging this into here. So you will have 1 over lambda phi.
So because a particle has a certain velocity, but the temperature is decreasing, so V by T bar half is increasing for that particle, is that correct?
I think so, if I understand your question correctly, then, yeah. So we get another overpopulation, which in a sense is worse than the over one, say for Hart sphere, and...
What's Z?
Z is the scaling variable V times T to the 1 to the lambda. So it's the argument here. So the point is, if there is no forcing and you do hydrodynamics, it tells you all energy goes away. And the way it does it is via the self-similar solutions. Okay, so now, now the question, are there no trivial steady states of this equation if we put this to zero? I'll go faster now. The naive answer is no. The naive answer is no, because we have this temperature decay is minus the dissipation rate, and the dissipation rate is a positively defined quantity. The dissipation rate is integral du1, du2, fu1, fu2, u1 minus u2 to the power 2 plus lambda. This will go away. It will be a positive, you know. Well, this answer is technically seems right, but it's wrong. There are steady states for these equations, and you can see this for solving one-dimensional Maxwell molecules. And now this would be basically, we will take this away, we will say it's one, and then our integral is the pure convolution. And in Fourier space, f of k is fpk, fqk, that's it. I could write Q as, I could write P as 1 minus Q, then I have F of K minus P minus QK. So I'll have your F of K minus QK, F of QK, which is really tells me the momentum transfer in the collision. I have a QK momentum transfer for one particle to the. This question has an exact solution, it's exponential, and its inverse is a Lorentz distribution, or Cauchy distribution. So you see something funny is going on, because this distribution has no, the energy density here is infinite, and the dissipation is infinite. So technically, maybe the resolution of this is that this lambda is infinite. This is infinite. This equation doesn't make any sense to begin with. And the way you can understand this, so I show this for lambda equals zero. I will show this in general now. We come back to the cascade process, and this is the cascade equation. At the steady state, we kill the time derivative, and we have this equation. And you can see that this power law behavior is a solution of this equation. So I will write the third type of solution, which is steady state or stationary state. And I'll write it only in one dimension.
This is now for the driven
for
system.
Undriven, but well, this is for the equation with the zero on the left-hand side, the time derivative set to zero. There is a steady state which has a power law tail.
This is a mathematical problem right now.
Yeah.
Okay. Asking whether this equation has a solution or
this
not.
This is in three dimensions?
This is one in 1D, but the same thing holds in any dimension. And this is how you would get this equation. It will have, again, a power law solution, and it will be a different exponent, which is a complicated function, but we can get it analytically. It's a root of some.
So is the energy finite?
In those solutions, the energy might be finite or infinite, but the energy dissipation is almost always infinite.
So this is the same. We have the same problem. You have the free cooling problem, and in one case, and what you're saying is that you can either get self-similar solutions.
Yes.
And get steady-state solutions.
Yes.
Both exist.
They both exist, and in a sense, it's like setting this number 1 over lambda to 0. It's another type of solution. So there is another type of solution for the Boltzmann equation, and we can show it analytically for the Maxwell molecule. I mean, this is sort of startling because we've been working with this equation for two decades now, and those solutions were overlooked. This is the power law.
What does it mean? These are steady-state solutions with no
energy loss? Well, let me keep the suspense, Jerry, for...
Okay.
I mean, you asked me if they are driven or not, and I had to bite my tongue. So, we know the exponent. We can calculate it analytically. We know it. There are bounds from the fact that the energy dissipated and the vector magnitude is increasing. One give you this bound, one give you the other bound. And this is what we have to know about them. The dissipation is always divergent, and the energies can be finite or infinite. Now, this is what this exponent looks. It depends on all the parameters. So that's the question we asked ourselves when we found this. What does it mean? I mean, can I generate this in Monte Carlo simulation? And what we did is start with compact distribution. And there's energy dissipation. So physically, we have to pump energy into the system. So, Jerry is the first answer. You have to pump energy into the system to maintain those steady states, because obviously, you know, the system will just do nothing, you know, come to a rest. The way we did it is we kept track of the energy loss. So this is sort of a theorist experiment. You let the particle dissipate energy, they dissipate and dissipate and dissipate, and you keep track. I've lost now two joules, 4 joules. And then you take that entire loss of energy and rarely award it to one particle chosen randomly. So it's like a lottery. So here's this interesting econophysics. This is sort of like you have taxation, and this is a lottery. And when you do that, you get the Pareto law. So this is Pareto law in econophysics, like. And when we did that, we know the form of the distribution, which is this Cauchy. We can reproduce it absolutely exactly. And we also have various prediction for the power laws. And we could do that in any in two dimension and three dimension and 1D and 2D for both two limiting cases, hard sphere and maximum molecule. Now the physics is here. The physics is here is that what we have is that we know we have a cascade process and we know we have a dissipation process. This thing has to be countered by an injection process. And this injection process has to occur at very large velocity scale. There's some cutoff on the velocity distribution. You cannot have really an infinite dissipation. So there's a cutoff. So this is log velocity distribution versus log velocity. So there is an injection scale and there's a typical scale. And you inject at a very large velocity, the energy cascades down and it evaporates over this power law range. And this process is at a steady state. And of course, there's an energy balance. The energy injected, gamma, this should have been here, gamma, it's injected at the rate, excuse me, this is the dissipation, no, this is right. This is the dissipation, should balance the injection, so injection is roughly gamma V square. So I pump it only at, so this is another type of forcing. We have to force this only the energetic particles. When we did why not, we force all particles, and here it is just the energetic particles. When you do that, if you one can generate that experimentally, then this power law should occur. And one sort of idea is to shoot like a bullet, you know, like you have a static medium, and when you shoot energetic particle into it, its energy should cascade down in velocity space. So,
is the system still just being homogeneous or not? It's no longer homogeneous.
In our theory, it is homogeneous. I have not put any space.
If it's homogeneous, can't you do the Boltzmann-X theorem for this?
Well, I know that.
Less than zero, right?
I'm not sure I know the answer for that, but I know that this is a dissipative system, and I don't think we have H theorem in general.
Well, H theorem will tell you the HTT is less than zero for dissipative systems, always.
Okay.
And the temperature goes to zero.
Okay.
So if you're getting a steady state, it has to fail somewhere.
Right? Yeah, it's we know it fails even for freely cooling. So in general, we don't have H theorem, but let me go on. So this is it. We have found yet a new type of solution for the Boltzmann equation. And one thing we can get is those scales of injection and typical or dissipation. We can get them out of by balancing the energy. So I think what is very important is can this be seen experimentally? I'd like to end just by saying that there is yet another type of solution which I will not bother to write on the board, where you have a power law up to a, it sort of interpolates between the freely cooling and the steady state. System is at a steady state up to a scale, and then it falls off as a stretch, just like in the freely cooling. So here, in a sense, it's a transient solution. Here, it's a stationary solution. And they can be patched up in the following manner, and we can get the scaling function here analytically. So this you can do analytically because you're working only with a linearized Boltzmann equation. All those velocities are very large, so you can get this. This is an exact expression for the freely cooling. We only have the tail, or we can get it in a perturbative way, but this here is a full exact solution, and we can verify that the theory is holding. So. These ones are from Monte Carlo simulation, so it's a numerical solution of the Boltzmann equation.
There's no experiment.
No, here no. So all those are important questions. What happens when you put space in? I think the key is that this cascade is really concerning only energetic particles. It's a linear process, so it's something very generic about it. We don't have to assume the full. You only have to assume maybe that energetic particle decouple from the rest. It's a much weaker assumption. It really all I've used here is the collision rules. That's all. So really we've used momentum conservation, energy dissipation, and it gives you this power laws. So.
What do you call this, a hybrid?
A hybrid. It's a hybrid because it's a steady state which we know the solution of here, and it's a transient cooling state, which we know the solution of here, and we just patched it together and say, well, can we get another solution? And this patching, you plug in, it works. And we could obtain that solution and verify it numerically. So there's a number four, which I will not write. So sorry for taking all your time. Or, well, you'll have another hour.
Yeah, we have been interested in particles with rotational degrees of freedom. And we have looked at two kinds of particles. So I'm also doing kinetic theory, but in contrast to what Ellie was talking about, the emphasis will be on rotational degrees of freedom. And we have looked at two kinds of systems to introduce or to couple to such rotational degrees of freedom. One system consists of rough spheres. So in the collision process, translational energy will be converted to rotational energy, and I'll tell you in a minute how we did this. And the other system are smooth needles. So think of cylinders whose dimension in this direction goes to zero. And then one doesn't even have to consider rough particles because due to the collisions, the particles will start to rotate. Now, I want to explain in some detail what the collision modes are. And then the way we do our theory is by using a Liouville operator, and I've been asked, a pseudo-Liouville operator, I've been asked by some people what this is, so I will explain it, not in detail, but try to make it plausible, and then show you some results for that. So the model I'm going to use for the rough spheres is the so-called Walton model, or some people call it, this is not really unique. And there's a nice paper by Fürst, it's in Physics of Fluids. There's some literature before, but I think this is nice to read if one hasn't heard of it. So what do we consider? We have spheres or disks in two dimensions. Oh, this shouldn't happen, sorry. We consider hard spheres. And let's say this is sphere one, sphere two. And we define a unit vector n pointing from sphere 1 to sphere 2, and now the particles have, in addition to a translational velocity, a rotational velocity. So let's think of disks for the moment because it's easiest. So they rotate, and similarly, of course, for the second one. And so what is of interest is the velocity at the contact point. This I denote by capital V, and it's the translational velocity, and then the radius of the particle is A. It's just n unit vector cross omega 1 minus and so the collision rule now refers to this velocity, relative velocity at the contact point after and before the collisions. So the collision wall is the following. Prime is now used for the velocity after the collision, and this is a normal component. This is, and I now use the notation Rn for the coefficient of restitution for the normal component, and then M cross P prime, and let me call this R sub T. And now we introduce an angle between the normal and the velocity of the contact point. Let me denote this by cos phi gamma and the absolute value of the relative velocity. And depending on this angle, we either use Coulomb friction or tangential restitution. So if the this impact angle is between pi over 2 and 3 pi over 2, and if the contact is almost sliding, we use Coulomb friction. So this is a case where, let's say, this is n, and the velocity of the contact point is almost perpendicular, not quite. Then, so this angle gamma, which in general is between pi over 2 and 3 pi over 2, so it's close to pi over 2, then we use Coulomb friction, and this implies n cross the momentum transfer is equal to mu and the normal component of the momentum transfer, and mu is this Coulomb friction parameter. And on the other hand, if this angle is close to pi, so almost head-on collisions, in other words, this is n, and the velocity is close to, I'm exaggerating here, but close to being head-on, then we use tangential restitution, which implies that n cross p prime is equal to minus 30 n cross. Now, with respect to all of these parameters, this is the normal restitution, so it's between 0 and 1. This is the tangential restitution, or this one here, is between minus 1 and plus 1. I was wondering about the sign there. Rt equal to minus 1 actually corresponds to perfectly smooth spheres, because nothing happens to the tangential component, and the normal component is just follows the usual law. And plus 1 corresponds to completely rough, or so-called completely rough. In both these limits, either minus 1 or plus 1, there's no energy dissipation due to these curves.
Can you explain this Coulomb friction in more details? What does it mean, gamma is just near pi over 2? I mean, is there a criteria, or how is it decided?
Just 1 minute. We are going now to interpolate between these two formulas. And this is actually what this paper is all about. And this is supported by the experiments quite well, I would say. When people do these experiments, just letting balls collide and mark it with an arrow, so they can actually look at the rotational motion, and then check the collision rules as well.
Are those balls or discs?
I think discs.
In the Coulomb friction formula, should there be a V prime on the left hand side? Or?
Yes, thanks. And so these two can be combined in what is this Ward model, and I don't do every detail of the calculation now, but that's why I've given this reference. It's well explained there. So one ends up with a coefficient of tangential restitution, which depends on the impact angle. I'm going to keep and this RT of gamma, if plotted versus gamma, and gamma I take now between pi over 2 and pi, because the other sector is identical by symmetry. And RT goes from minus 1 to plus 1, and the typical curve would look like the following. In this region, we have Coulomb friction, and then we have some constant tangential restitution. So this would be the, let's call it RTM, the maximum value, which is then this one, and this is the Coulomb friction curve. Okay.
So once you use this function, you include Coulomb friction also, or you just substitute this for the Coulomb friction?
No, this includes both Coulomb friction for contacts which are sliding, and constant tangential restitution for sticking contacts. And this is well confirmed by the experimental data, I would say. We are running kind of late, so shall I explain the collision rules for the needles or not?
Yes, take your time.
Okay, so let's get to the needles. A needle is characterized by its orientation, and this I introduce a unit vector which specifies the orientation of the needle. Now, if we have two needles, these are two vectors, and these two vectors span a plane, except for the case where they are parallel, but this is not what I'm considering, okay? So these two vectors span a plane, and I'm going to draw this now,
Is that really true? You can always put a plane through two lines?
Two vectors span a plane.
Oh, vectors, not lines.
Yeah. So one, say U1 and the other one U2, always span a plane, except for the case where they are parallel, but this is unlikely. So let's say we have one needle here, and it's a needle, but I draw it as a bar right now, so I make sure. You can understand it, and its vector is 1, and let's say we have another one here, and this is the center of mass, and this is U2, and this is this plane now, and this is the distance between the two projected into the plane. That's why I call it R12 parallel. And now this vector I call S12 U 1. And this vector, I'm going to call as 2, 1, u2. And so I want to use a local basis now consisting of u1, u2, and the third vector which I call u3, and it's just u1 plus u2, and because these two are perpendicular, I have to give up the absolute value. And so I can decompose the relative distance into a part which is in the plane spanned by u1 and u2, and the part which is perpendicular, so in the direction of u curve. Now the particles are in contact. If this perpendicular distance is 0, we're talking about needles, so. And S12 has to be smaller than L over 2, so I denote by L the length of the particle. And similarly, S21 has to be smaller than L over 2. And then I can again define the velocity of the contact point, and the contact point can of course be anywhere on this, on the rod, as the difference between the translational velocities, and then the part from the rotational velocities I write as S12 u1 minus S21 u2 dot, and this is a value of the u, so this is the analog of the omega. And then one can formulate the collision rules just as we did before. So the normal component will be reduced, but the coefficient of normal restitution is taken to be smaller than 1, and this is the only case we consider, and the tangential component for simplicity is left untouched.
The in contact thing should be R12 parallel, right? R12, is there R12 parallel or R12 prime?
Perpendicular. And I forgot one thing, R12 parallel. Now there's a component in the direction of U1 and U2, and this determines the S12, U1.
It might look more complicated than it actually is. If one sits down and has time to work it out, it's quite obvious. Of course, it would be much harder if we didn't consider needles, but kept cylinders or anything like that. Okay, so these are the two kinds of objects which allow us to consider the transfer of translational energy to rotational energy, either because the surface of the particles is rough or the particles are spherically symmetric, but in this case needles, and thereby pick up angular momentum once they collide. Now, how do we describe the time evolution of this system? I forgot to mention one thing, and maybe I should. Let's consider the three-dimensional problem. Then these equations here are actually three equations, one normal and two tangential components. So we get three equations from here. We get another three equations from momentum conservation, And then in such a collision, the angular momentum of particle 1 defined with respect to the contact point is conserved because there's no torque. So the angular momentum of particle 1 with respect to this contact point is conserved, and the angular momentum of particle 2 with respect to the contact point is conserved. So these are three equations for each particle, so six equations in all, so 12 equations in all together, and this is just sufficient to compute these 12 quantities. In terms of the ones before the collision. And similar counting argument applies over there. Okay, I think I erased the needles because I lost what I'm going to say is probably easier for the spheres.
The assumption that the angular momentum of the particles are conserved separately is based on the fact that the particles are hard.
Yeah.
If the particles are of different radius, they are still hard. But I think this...
it was still applied.
It was still applied. Still
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not conserved in the reference frame at the center of the particles. It's conserved in the reference frame at the point
just
of contact.
You have to, a big particle cannot translate a lot of momentum to the smaller.
No, just no. I mean, there is, if you look at these, there will be non-zero delta omega. But if you look at the angular momentum with respect to the contact point, which has a part n cross v sub 2. This is conserved because there's no torque acting at this point. I've really drawn it badly. This is a point and not a Hertzian contact or anything like that.
But I wonder whether this is consistent because, I mean, if you have a particle and say they have different sense of rotation, or have the same one sense of rotation, this is the same one. Both of them get slower in absolute value. And if one of them is really big,
yeah.
It doesn't care much about the other one.
It would
transform a lot of, I mean, physics, not in the model, not in the model, but in physics, would transfer a lot of momentum to the smaller one. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, and the small one will presumably pick up an angular velocity.
It means at least that the size of the product has to be similar.
No. I mean, it has to do with a point contact. I'm not sure how it would be if the particles were deformable and then I would have a surface of contact, like a Hertzian contact.
Then it's really complicated. And then there's a full mechanics of the contact.
Yeah, and that probably...
But so long as there's no torque acting at the point of contact, the angular momentum at that point has to be conserved.
But if we have different radius, we just have to generalize this capital V definition to A1 and A2. That's
right.
All.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here, as long as the particles are hard, this wouldn't change.
Well, I mean, if they are the same size, then this agrees with our experience. And then the Hertzsphere model is justified. But if they are really different, then this would give results which wouldn't agree with our experience.
If the particles are strictly hard, yeah, let's maybe discuss it later. So these were the collision rules, and the next thing I want to explain, not really in detail, but at least like plausible, is what we call the pseudo Liouville operator. Probably everyone remembers or knows what the Liouville operator is, but I take one second to remind you anyhow.
we have a classical many particle system, you describe it by a Hamiltonian, so let's say we have capital N particles, we have kinetic energy, and I take all the masses to be equal, and the potential energy, let's say some pair potential. And then when we want to know the time dependence of some observable, let's say the kinetic energy or whatever it is, which depends on all of these R's and P's, and I'm not going to make this notation explicit, then we know that the DDT, the time derivative of such an observable, is given by the Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian. And I assume here that there's no explicit time dependence on of F to make this simple. And this defines the real world operator. And so then we can write the formal solution simply as the now, this Poisson bracket, HF, this is summed over I, the N, the I.
Yeah. Oh, she defined it as I.
Yeah.
This is the way I defined it. Yeah, some people do it differently, but I think this is consistent.
Yeah.
In
fact, I become summation.
This is the standard definition, I believe, because for elastic systems, L is Hermitian.
Hermitian, yeah.
As
yeah,
it is defined now.
Yeah. Yeah. Without the I, it's not Hermitian.
Yeah. But this is standard. I just let me just go over it quickly. And so the first part is easy. The H, the direction with respect to the momentum is just the momentum itself. So this is usually defined as L0. And so this is just the first part of this bracket, and is Pi over M times the gradient with respect to Ri. And this is
translational.
This is what's called the free-streaming part. The particles just move freely without any interactions. And now the second part is the one which is sensitive to the interactions. And as you see, this is only well defined if the potential is differentiable. So for the hardcore system, this is not defined. And therefore, people have, in for the elastic system, come up with what is called the pseudo-Liouville operator, which I think is quite useful, not like this one. I'm not aware of any one using this one for differential for potentials. But this pseudo-Liouville operator is really quite useful. And the way it is constructed is the following. We want to work out the change, let's say, of the energy in a collision. And so let's consider a collision of two particles. If I'm done by 12, is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is the last point I'm going to explain in some detail. Collision of two particles. Let's say particle I and particle J. And we want to construct an operator that gives us this change of the variable. So because the collision is instantaneous, we can only hope that this operator will give us a change of the variable if we integrate it over a small time interval delta t around the collision. So this operator should give us the change of, let's say, F integrated over a small time interval around the collision. And then it should only act on the variable if a collision, if the particles are in contact. And of course, approaching. So how does it look like? And let me just write it down for the spheres. The particles have to be in contact, that's easy, so the relative distance of the two spheres has to be equal to the diameter. They have to be approaching, so this is this condition. And then we introduce an operator, I'll explain in a moment what it does, which updates the velocities and the angular velocities. So let's say V12 is acting on it will produce and all the others untouched. And then we also have to take care of the flux of the particles, or what Ellie calls the collision frequency. So there's a term like that. This corresponds to the lambda equal to 1 in Ellie's case for the hard spheres. And then we have to sum over all possible collisions. So we sum over all pairs. And this is, I claim, the interaction part of the of this operator.
So you're actually doing it for the pair distribution, or you're factorizing into single particles?
Excuse me?
Are you doing it for the pair distribution in this, or are you factorizing to single particle?
No, at the moment I haven't done anything, right? I just made plausible that we could introduce such a pseudo-neural operator. Now, when I actually want to do
this calculus. This applies to the many body.
Yeah.
Distribution.
No, all
this applies to the
n part.
Yeah, I could add here and so on, but it just wouldn't change.
Take anything.
This changes the velocities before the collision to those after the collision. And originally this was derived by the Dutch school, Ernst, Hoffman, Van Leeuwen, and I don't know, some other people, for the elastic case. So the collision rules taking V1 into prime quantity, omega 1 into the prime, and so on, were the elastic ones. But of course, now we are going to use the collision rules whatever we want. So we are going to use the inelastic ones with the normal restitution, the tangential restitution, and Coulomb.
I see, that's why you use the word pseudo.
The word pseudo comes about because even in the elastic case, this operator is no longer Hermitian. Second. But this is actually an advantage. It sounds so horrible, but it actually isn't, because this allows you to compute matrix elements, which for the one here would be zero.
There's no problem with this sounds only in methods in a dissipated system. It's really okay.
No, I'm not using the Hamiltonian methods in a dissipated system. Sorry, I probably didn't explain it well enough. I tried to make plausible the
construction of this guy by first starting with the Hamiltonian many particle systems to just kind of get you on the track what this operator is all about. Then noticing that it's not well defined for even an elastic hardcore system because this doesn't exist. And so what people first did was introduce this one for elastic systems, and now I'm going to forget all this Hamiltonian part, but just take over this for the inelastic system.
But so far, this is still an exact representation of the evolution of the n particle distribution.
And of course, I do have to make approximations now if I really want to compute anything.
And so far, it is a linear formulation.
No.
Linear in F?
Linear.
No, but this could be an n particle distribution.
No, no, but it's linear. It's all linear in F.
Oh, okay. Like quantum mechanics.
Yes.
Yeah.
But nowhere we use really energy conservation or the tools of equilibrium statistical physics.
No.
We don't.
We don't. So far.
Otherwise, this would be an exact.
Don't we have to have factor 1 over E somewhere? ET or something? Because for particles before collision, the velocity, delta velocity, has to be larger.
I mean, if you apply this to, let's say, the energy.
Yeah.
You will get something like
a loss.
A loss.
Yeah, right.
With a negative sign. Yeah. Okay.
No, the fact that two particles which collide and give you final velocity v1, v2, the initial relative velocity has to be larger because you're losing energy in a collision.
Yeah, but this is taken care of by the collision modes, and the collision modes are somewhere hidden in this.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not in the Leonard operator itself. You were thinking about some phase space factor.
Yeah, phase space contraction.
No, not in here. Okay, so now when we actually want to do calculations with this, what we basically do, we compute matrix elements of this operator. And so we compute like the initial decay rate of the energy, or one could even go a bit further. And one of the simplest things one can do is the homogeneous cooling state. And given that it's almost noon, I think I skipped the some of the details there. Yeah, it must be exhausted. So we make an assumption about the many particle distribution function corresponding to the homogeneous cooling state. There's maybe one addition to what Ellie was talking about using the Boltzmann equation. We do take into account excluded volume. We have to. The particles have a finite size, so if you want to compare it to kinetic theory, it would correspond in some way to the Enskog. It's similar to the Enskog kind of approach. And so what we compute then is a time evolution, for example, of the translational, average translational energy, which is defined as and let's say the rotational energy, this is defined in terms of the moment of inertia, it is called I here. And we look, for example, at the time evolution of these guys. And the average, and I haven't really told you how we compute the average. Just in words, we assume a homogeneous cooling state.
So you assume this is in a sense similarity state.
Even more, we usually take the simplest, then we assume in the Maxwellian, and even the same, even isotropic. One can do better, and in fact, in the thesis which I showed you, there are no Gaussian corrections.
So you assume a form for f. You assume the form for f with the variable temperature,
right,
which you have yet to specify, and then see self-consistently extract the temperature,
precisely,
the two, T rotational and T translational.
Yeah. And I think I just give you the results, or some of the results, which I wanted to show you. Spheres evolving according to this Walton model, and this is a model of the smooth needles. And what we usually observe is as the following. We look at the ratio of the rotational temperature to the translational, now the other way around, the translational, the average translational energy over the average rotational energy. And this goes to a constant value very quickly, as seen here, whereas the total energy continues to decrease. And what is shown here, the lines are the simplest analytical theory as compared to results of event-driven simulations. And this was done for an area fraction rather low, 0.1. This is the same result, or an analogous result, for the needles. So in this case, it's again the ratio of the translational temperature over the rotational temperature going to a constant quickly, whereas the total energy keeps on decaying. And again...
Question about this?
Yeah?
The translational energy is about 1% of the rotational energy. I'm wondering why that is. Is it because the translational energy is being strongly dissipated by the collisions and the rotational energy less so?
That's exactly one.
Yeah, exactly one. But it's a very important point, because every partition doesn't hold. Usually we would argue that every partition determines that we have 1/2 kVT per degree of freedom, and we can just count the degrees of freedom, and this will give us the ratio. But this does not work here.
Yeah, I figured, I thought it was 10 minutes to, but that's not.
Probably it's a different scale. But let me get to this point, because this is precisely the question. What is plotted here is this ratio. This is done for the needles in this plot. And this ratio depends on the coefficient of normal restitution. Sorry, this was epsilon down here. And it also depends on the mass distribution along the plot. For example, a homogeneous mass distribution corresponds to this curve here. But you can also think of a dumbbell or of the mass mainly concentrated in the middle or whatever. And you see that you can obtain different values depending on the mass distribution is parameterized on this scale.
So it's not all that far.
You can get close to one, but it's a crazy value for this.
Well, it's not a factor of 10 or something.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. And there's, of course, no volume fraction for the needles because they don't have a volume, but to give you an idea, the center of mass separation is comparable to the mass of the
So those two figures are needles.
Those two figures are needles.
And now it's disks.
The disks are the... No, these are actually three-dimensional...
Balls.
And we have chosen parameter values. Of course, you can do this systematically, and I just wanted to give you one of these results for, let's say, normal restitution. There you go, 0.3. So this is RN, sorry. So it's quite inelastic. Uh-huh. This is a value of mu, and this is a value of 0.8.
But if it's assumed to be
Maxwellian, we know that actually it is not. It is, okay, so how does it come up to be so accurate?
In this range of density, we would never see any deviations, even though maybe in this region there is already a shear instability, and surely in the ground zones pretty soon. Or if there is strong clustering of the density, strong inhomogeneities.
So this deviation is irrelevant for us?
Yeah, it seems like it.
We have to set 0.3, which is extremely inelastic.
Yeah. Not, I mean, these are really event, honest to God, event-driven simulations, and they lie on almost on top of the theory, right?
Yeah.
But when you look for the density specifically, you see that it's clustered,
yeah,
and I can show you.
Like, I mean, I'm concerned about the deviation from Maxwellian, but you have an integral value now, therefore deviations are
that's true.
Out.
Yeah, that's right. Just one last transparency, and then I'm done. This is a picture for the needles from the event-driven simulations. So these are like 20,000 needles. And I basically wanted to show it to you because we have been talking so much about these shear instabilities, first discussed by Hans and what you see here are these like two shear vents or two vortices going this way. So what we have done here, this is a higher density. I've shown the picture before. And we have defined an average flow like by dividing our boxes into cells, such that on average there are 25 needles in the cell, and this arrow represents the flow. And when we have a situation like that, we do see deviations.
So your system, if you let it run long enough, it does create clusters and it becomes unstable.
Yeah. Now, this last one thing I wanted to show you, because we have been talking about molecular chaos quite a bit. And what is shown here is the distribution of impact angles. Now, when you think of scattering as it is in the textbooks, you know that molecular chaos corresponds to assuming that the collision parameter it's usually called B, so if you think in terms of the center of scattering in the separate force field, it's a distance, perpendicular distance, where the particles come in. If molecular chaos were to hold, then this would be constant, whatever constant is viewed. But we have defined our angles slightly differently because of the angle between the normal and the contact point. So we have to do some computation. I just mentioned this because don't be surprised that you don't see a uniform distribution of sine theta. And so what is plotted here is the distribution of this impact angle for various parameters, tangential restitution and also Coulomb friction. And again, we compare event-driven simulations, these are the symbols, with the simplest theory assuming molecular chaos. But this is done for a driven system, a system which was driven in the same way as Ellie talked about, namely kicking the particles randomly. And as you see, molecular chaos seems to be very well, seems to hold quite well in this randomly kicked gas, which doesn't imply that it holds in the Pauli case or whatever other system. Or maybe one which is driven from the walls. Yeah, that's all. Okay. Sorry that it has taken such a long time.
Is there an outcome that is relevant to experimental?
One thing that has been checked, for example, or looked at, is this ratio of translational to rotational energy. This was done also, for example, by Mignon in this experiment Eddie mentioned.
I mean, one of the motivations to go to the needles was to get away from this perfectly spherical particles, because we kind of expected, or wanted to ask the question whether this matters for the system. It's a bit unfortunate that so far we were only able to do needles. Everything else seems utterly complicated and one wants to do.
It makes sense.
Yeah, but possibly.
I mean, I think this brings you this whole issue of rotation. There's very scarce experimental input on that question. Rotational degrees of freedom, distribution of rotational energies.
Yeah, we can accommodate it. Of course, it's a particular set of these parameters, and I don't have it right now. Yeah, we could check that, yeah.
For instance, velocity